Yeah, we're discussing the Agadata of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, and in particular the very dramatic story of Sancheirib, the king of Assyria, that after he conquered and exiled the 10 tribes, he then went southward to Yerushalayim, and on the verge of destroying the city and capturing, destroying the Beis HaMikdash as well, there was a great miracle that the night of Pesach, it was Pesach night, 185,000 of his soldiers got wiped out in a miraculous plague. And as the Gemara said, that that was the moment that Chizkiyahu could have become the Mashiach, and that means there wouldn't have been a destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and that war would have been what is called the Wars of Gog and Magog. See, it's interesting, in the Nabi Yechezkel, there's a great description that before the coming of the Mashiach, there will be a war of the nations of Gog and Magog, which are really unknown to us, against the Jewish people. And Gog and Magog can really be anything. It just means some nations, in fact, of Persia, Zahol Arichas, that Gog and Magog are symbolic names. They are not the names of actual nations. Gog comes, and Magog, both words come from the word Gog, a roof. And the first points out very beautiful thoughts that we find that the monarchy of David HaMelech is called the Sukkah. That's why we say on Sukkah, do you remember this sentence? Also, the famous Kalbach Nigin, if you don't remember convention. Harachaman hu yakim lanu es Sukkas David Hanofalas. May the Merciful One restore to us the fallen Sukkah of David. So what does that mean? The Malchus, which is Mashiach, the Malchus of Mashiach is called a Sukkah. And the Malchus of the Umos HaOlam is called a roof, a Gog. What is the difference in a Sukkah and a Gog?
Permanence.
Say again?
Permanence.
Yeah, permanence. And also a Sukkah is not supposed to keep the rain out, right? There's actually a halacha. At least the Sukkah might be kosher. But the Chatzchila, the Schach should not be so thick that it keeps out the rain, and you should be able to see the stars between the pieces of schach. So in a sukkah, you're always conscious of the fact that Hashem is above. A gog tries to block God away from things and kind of create your own faith. So Rav Hirsch says, the reason why the final enemies of the Jews are called the Wars of Gog and Magog is because they represent the powers of secularism and godlessness that look at the world as a roof to separate themselves from Hashem, as opposed to Sukkah, which is always cognizant of Hashem. I'm going to ask you a question on that after. So consequently, Rav Hirsch points out that Gog and Magog are not like a specific nation, but rather the struggle of godlessness against Kedusha is the war of Gog and Magog. And that's why people over the years have identified it maybe as Nazi Germany. We hope that was the War of Gog and Magog, because then that means it won't be anything worse. Or some say even the Cold War, the War of the Soviet Union, because the War of Heresy and Apikorsis, the denial of God, etc. There is an interesting comment from the Vilna Gaon, I think I mentioned to you, that he writes somewhere, and I'm trying to find this quote. I've seen it wrote down in secondary sources, that he wrote, Al-Pi Kabbalah, that the final war of Gog and Magog before Mashiach comes is going to last 9 minutes. And people didn't know what that meant, what type of war could last 9 minutes. But 250 years later, we know a war can last 9 minutes, nuclear war and the like. So it seems to be almost, God forbid, that it should be, that the Vilna Gaon was indicating that Gog and Magog might be some type of nuclear war. Then we hope not. Now, my kasha on this is this. I have a little kasha in Rav Hirsch's chat. So Rav Hirsch defines Gog and Magog as the forces of godlessness that try to make a roof between themselves and Hashem, as opposed to the Malchus Beis Dovid in Klal Yisrael, which is the idea of a sukkah. That would suggest that the last cosmic struggle is that between like atheism and secularism versus holiness. And you know, and that was true, Nazism, because although Nazism, was a secular movement, and Nazism was a godless movement, although they sometimes utilized Christianity, but the truth is Hitler was against the Christians too, who believed in God. And certainly the Soviet Union was an atheistic government. But our problem is that we see in recent decades that the real last struggle that we're facing is really against Islamic fundamentalism, which believes in God. And in fact, there's actually a medrash in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, which is an old medrash, it's a very old medrash, that says that the last enemy that we will face before Mashiach is going to be Malchus Yishmael, the kingdom of Yishmael. And it says Yishmael is the most dangerous of all enemies, because it is the only nation besides the Jews that has Hashem's name in their name. Aleph Lamed, Kael is Hashem's name. Yisrael, Yishmael. And it's also true that just like Am Yisrael's koach is in tefillah, Yishmael also has a koach in tefillah, right? About 5 times a day, etc. So it seems not as being described that the final messianic war, or pre-messianic war, is not going to be between godlessness and God, but it will be between those who use Hashem's name for evil purposes versus those who use Hashem's name for Kedusha. That's a different description. So we wouldn't describe the Muslims as God. We wouldn't describe them as denying God. We would describe them as perverting God. That's a very different thing. I would say they're very religious, etc., but they use Hashem's name for evil things. Now, it's true, though, I have to admit, that Chazal always talk about, except for this one medrash, Chazal always talk about Esav as being the last enemy, and Esav does represent Kefira and denial of Hashem. But Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer says Yishmael is going to be the last enemy, and unfortunately, I think we've seen that medrash is coming true. Now, the truth is, both enemies can exist at the same time, meaning to say we are buffeted by materialism and secularism, and then we are buffeted by religious fanaticism and evil coming from that side. So it could be that the last enemy is a mizug, a combination of the Kayach of Esav and the Kayach of Yishmael that's getting you on both sides. But the reason I'm bringing this up, intrinsically it's important, is that is why, like, anyone could become Gog and Magog. That's what we're saying, that if Chizkiyahu would have been worthy, if the Jewish people would have been worthy, we would have treated Sancheiriv as the Gog, fill in the blanks. He would have been the Gog and Magog enemy, and Chizkiyahu would have been Mashiach, and there wouldn't have been a Chorban, except Chizkiyahu, number one, didn't say Shira to Hashem properly, and the Jewish people were not Zocha, so as a result, it remained a great miraculous victory. It did remain a great victory, but it did not turn into Mashiach, it did not turn into the final Geula, and therefore 100 years later, there was the Chorban Beis HaMikdash, and later there was the other Chorban Beis HaMikdash, and we are still in Galus. So many things potentially could have, it's an important idea, there are potential Messianic days. See, this explains another anomaly. I'm not going to go into all the particulars. Maybe later we'll have a little bit of a discussion. I think I mentioned the other day that the great Tana, Yonasan ben Uziel, who was the Talmud of Hillel, and he's the one, he's buried in a mukkah. If you're single, you go and you dive in there for a shidduch. Have you ever been to a mukkah? It's near Sfax. A mukkah means a deep valley. It's a very deep valley. At night, it's totally dark. It really is mamish totally dark. You look up at the sky and you see millions of stars. Very amazing. You understand what Kochva Heshemaya means. And the only lights you have there at all are the lights of your car or your bus. It's mamish totally dark. And Yonasan ben Uziel was described as the greatest of Hillel's Talmidim. The greatest of Hillel's Talmidim. He wrote the Aramaic Targum of the Nevi'im. And he explains it in many different ways, and more often says, without the Targum of the Nevi'im, right, Unkelus wrote the Targum of the Torah. Now, Unkelus is very literal. Remember, Unkelus is literal. Unkelus does not bring in Midrashim and things. He might be Meramesh to it, but generally speaking, Unkelus is word for word. But the Targum Yainasan on Nevi'im is not just a word for word, but he'll bring in many Midrashim and the like. It's a much more expansive Targum. Now, the Gemara in Megillah says he wanted to write a Targum on Kesuvim, but a great earthquake came and Hashem stopped him from writing the Targum on Kesuvim. What's so bad about a Targum on Kesuvim? Why did Hashem have to stop him? So the Gemara in Megillah says that in the book of Daniel, remember Daniel is the colleague of Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, who lived during the 70 years of the Babylonian exile. Daniel was given all sorts of visions about when Mashiach will come. And there are calculations, there are cheshbonos in the book of Daniel. You count 70 cycles of the, you know, the problem is they're very obscure. But he was going to clarify what the cycles were. And he would therefore be Megala the case. He would reveal the end of days when the Mashiach is going to come. So Hashem made an earthquake so he would stop. So Hashem said, you're not allowed to reveal these secrets.
Is that a contradiction to the fact that we're going to have Mashiach every day?
No, we're certainly going to have Mashiach. But the point is, he didn't want Daniel to reveal when exactly Mashiach is coming. In other words, if you could unlock the secrets in the book of Daniel, you would know what year and what month Mashiach is coming.
No, no, but I'm saying like a prediction of a when automatically takes away every time, like every day, the idea of every day Mashiach.
So that's not a stira necessarily, because there are two different levels here. There is a level, thank you, there is an outer limit by which he must come. Now, we often say that's by the year 6000, but that's not so clear. Mm-hmm. And then there's an ability to bring it early by mitzvos and by zechusim. So we believe that every single day it's within our koach to bring the Mashiach. Mm-hmm. But we also believe there is a defined time by which, ready or not, he must come. In fact, you're making a very good point. Part of why, because you may wonder, what is so bad if he reveals the outer limits when Mashiach would come? You know, what is so bad about that? So the Malbim says what is so bad about that is that if it's very distant in the future, people will give up hope and they won't realize they could still bring Mashiach by their Torah and Masim Tovim. So we don't want to tell them it'll be so far in the future. That's why the Malbim actually has a chiddush. The Malbim's chiddush is interesting. The Malbim, I mentioned that over the years, I think I mentioned a few days ago, over the years, many Mephorshim tried to interpret Daniel to come up with specific dates. Rav Sadia Gaon did it in the 900s, and Rashi did it in the 1000s, and the Ramban did it in the 1100s. Those are the famous ones. And then other people, in other words, they all like gave dates that were usually like 50 years ahead of them. And they would show how it fit all the psukim. And the last one who did it, I mean, Christians still do it, but the last Jewish gadol who did it was the Malbim. And the Malbim wrote in like 1870, and the Malbim predicted 1921 as the day of Mashiach. Again, these are based on the verses in Daniel, different ways of interpreting the verses. And the Malbim actually dealt with the question, how am I allowed, listen to this question, how am I allowed to give you the date of Mashiach? Don't Chazal say it's forbidden to give the date of Mashiach? So the Malbim said that that's only usher if the date of Mashiach is far into the future, because people will give up hope. But when your date is relatively nearby, so people will be able to look forward to it, he says it's not usher. That's what the Malbim said. The Emes is, I think that's a very, very schwer, because if anything, I think it has a backfire effect, because if I give you a date that's way in the future, you don't get disillusioned. If I give you a date that Mashiach is supposed to come like next year and he doesn't, then you get tzibrachim. You know, okay, I mean, in a way, unless you know for sure your date is right, and who knows that their date is right, it's even worse to give a near date than to give a distant date. But okay, this is what the Malbim says. Now the thing is this. How do we understand the fact that Rav Sadia Gaon gave a date, and Rashi gave a date? These were great, great gedolim. They just made a mistake. I mean, they just misinterpreted. They just, what they said was false. Is there any reason to learn it, for example? Should I learn Rashi's commentary on Daniel if Rashi gives me false dates? So there's a deeper understanding here. None of those dates were false. Rather, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives messianic nevuos in an open-ended way that could fit any number of dates. And what that means is that each of those dates, Rav Sadia Gaon's date, Rashi's date, Ramban's date, and even the Malbim's date, was a date in which there was a strong messianic koach in the air that could have been taken advantage of. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu bedaf, because it was not a question, what date does Hashem mean is in his nevuah? But HaKadosh Baruch Hu's nevuah can refer to any of those dates, and maybe other dates as well, that one could figure out. because HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts his nevuah in such an eifen that if we are deserving, it'll be this earlier interpretation, and if we're not deserving, it'll be a later interpretation. See? Mashenkin of Hashem would have said a given date, Hashem Kavyachal would be tied down by that. Hashem didn't want to be tied down by that, so he gave you. So, therefore, it turns out that what would be interesting is, in each of these dates, there would be a hisorvus of the Ula. There was an awakening, an arousal of the Ula, which didn't, you know, unfortunately, didn't manifest itself, and the like. So, and this idea that something can be a messianic moment, but we can lose it, we see this from the Gemara here. That's exactly the story of Chizkiyahu and Gog Magog and Sancheirith, that indeed this could have been the messianic moment, and it passed. I think I explained that that's the similar idea with Rabbi Akiva and Bar Kokhba. Rabbi Akiva thought that Bar Kokhba was Mashiach, so was Rabbi Akiva wrong? The answer is, I can't say we know for sure, but one can certainly learn Rabbi Akiva was not wrong. Bar Kokhba would have been Mashiach had the generation been worthy. Since it was not worthy, Bar Kokhba remained a warrior and a military hero, and Bar Kokhba was eventually killed. And you see this idea, really, because even though there are zamanim in which the messianic koach is much stronger, Mashiach can come every day. Can come every day. And that means in the world this moment, this very moment, there is somebody who is going to be Mashiach, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu says now is the time. It has to be that way. Because if I believe Mashiach can come today, Mashiach can come tomorrow, well, who's going to be Mashiach if he comes tomorrow? It's not somebody coming from heaven, it's a human being on earth. So that means at every moment in time, there is somebody who's going to be Mashiach. Now, does he know that? Maybe not. Maybe he doesn't even know. And maybe he'll live and die without ever knowing if the Zman did not come. See, we don't know. Mashiach doesn't know he's Mashiach when he's born, necessarily. The Chassam Sofer says a riot to this idea is Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu did not know he was going to be the Moshiach and Shel Yisrael till he was 80 years old. For 80 years, Moshe had no idea what his destiny was. And he says Mashiach is the same way. Mashiach does not know that he's Mashiach until Hashem appoints him to redeem the Jewish people.
And whose koach is it more dependent? Because if Israel was in the Brian Halot Tuma in Mitzrayim, and then Moshe came, and there are multiple times when Moshe had to pray for it, God said, well, I'll kill the people. And then he prayed, and then they weren't killed. So it seems almost as if it is entirely dependent on the koach of Mashiach himself to bring about the Messianic age.
Well, yeah, it's a mix. Well, of course, but Hashem gave him the green light. In other words, Mashiach doesn't do it on his own. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him now is the time to go.
Right.
And Moshe did not go until Hashem told him to go. But in terms of the schus, it does work both ways, because there is a concept that Mashiach can come when we become righteous, or Mashiach can come when we're so bad that if he doesn't come now, we'll disappear. So Mashiach can come either in a generation that's totally righteous or a generation that's totally impure. So in Mitzrayim, it was closer to the lower end of the...
And the times when Hashem would destroy Klal Yisrael without Moshe praying?
Well,
that was also the all the way down, or...?
Well, that was after the Chet HaEgel, that was after the great, great sins, when Hashem wanted to destroy B'nai Israel, and Moshe prayed. But that's a little different. See, that's a different scenario, because there, Moshe was already designated to be the leader of the Jewish people. So once he's given the job of being a leader, then he has the job to pray for them no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
Theoretically, if that could happen after Mashiach comes, although he probably won't, the Mashiach would have that same role. But here we're talking about pre-messianic instructions, where the Mashiach has not gotten any message from Hashem.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just saying, Mashiach does not know that he's Mashiach. That's what I always said. That's why the Babichu Rebbe didn't say he was Mashiach, didn't say he wasn't Mashiach before his stroke. Because if people think he's Mashiach, and he could be, most of us kind of know we're not in the league, but if you might be, what are you supposed to say? You can't say yes, you can't say no. You know, you kind of wait for a sign from Shemayim, what the situation is. And that's the difficult burden that such a gadol would have, in just not knowing and waiting to see what will happen in a Shemayim, waiting for some message. And that's a genuine doubt. Okay. Now, if you remember, what we said was this. What we said was, there's a pasuk here that the Gemara turns prophecies of doom into things that have a positive meaning. That there was a prophecy that says, "Lo mu'af liasher mutzak lo." And this now mu'af is lashon of oyef. Oyef means exhaustion. There is no exhaustion to he who will oppress. Now, literally, this means Sancheirib is described as an oppressor, and the Navi is describing that Sancheirib is going to be so fast and so skillful that he won't be exhausted. He'll just run from empire to empire and topple the Jewish people, the 10 tribes, and then Yerushalayim. But the Gemara says that may have been the way Sancheirib understood it, that God was giving him permission to do this. But really, you could translate the words in a very different way. Lo mu'af l'asher mutzak la, instead of meaning there is no tiredness to he who oppresses, what it means is the tired one shall not be delivered to the oppressor. And what that means is that the nation that exhausts itself in Torah, it's a different way of translating the words, The nation that is tired because of its work at Amelus and Torah shall not belong to the oppressor. Instead of saying there is no exhaustion to the oppressor, it means there is no exhausted people who will be delivered to the oppressor. And that was the great sechus of Chizkiyo, that Chizkiyo created a society, really, of people who were Amel the Torah. The Gemara says, Ad Kedei Kach, that from the north of Eretz Israel to the south, there was not a single boy or girl, a little boy or little girl, who didn't know the complicated laws of purity and impurity. And again, I just want to remind you, if you don't remember Tanakh, Chizkiyo's father was a very big Russia, and Chizkiyo's son was a very big Russia, because Chizkiyo had a brief period in the middle where he brought people to Tshuva, and he could have been the source of Mashiach. And the great koach Chizkiyo had was that he spread the learning of Torah among all segments of the people, even the small children. They were very conversant with the laws of purity and impurity. And it was the zechus of the Torah that was matzil them miraculously from the attacks of Sancheirib.
Was there as much then as there is now in terms of content to learn?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. Obviously, in terms of books, they didn't have it. They didn't have a book or a books called Gemara. Gemara was not written down in any way. In fact, the only book they had was the Chumash and whatever biblical books were already written. Most of them weren't even written yet either. I mean, they had the book Yehoshua, Shofter, you know, they didn't have Malachim yet. Those were written later. So basically, the oral law was literally the oral law, meaning they would learn Chumash, and the teacher would explain all the different laws based on the Chumash. And what eventually got written down and codified was taught Baal Peh in those days, and the like. I mean, the truth is, think about this. Every generation, we add Svarim all the time. I mean, Rashi didn't have Tosos. Tosos didn't have Tosos, Rashi didn't have Rashi, right? Every generation is adding different things to try to explain, but we believe that the central ideas were part of the oral law, and therefore, even before they were written down, they were known to the great teachers who then taught them to people, and in Chizkiyo's time, even the youngest children any of these complicated halachas.
I'd say there might have been not as many like machloket as there were, or like have the need to explain Rabbi Akiva's words versus these words.
Well, keep in mind the following. There's nothing you need to keep in mind, and that is when there was a Sanhedrin of 71, then there were disputes, but disputes were resolved by a vote, meaning to say 35 rabbis say so-and-so, 36 say the other way. So the halacha is 36. So when we would be teaching it, I wouldn't be teaching, oh, the 36 judges say this and the 35 judges say this. The halacha would just be based on the majority. So when you had a Sanhedrin, every machlokas was resolved, and as a result, as part of the Torah Shebaal Peh, there was only one view that had to be presented. So the notion of comparing different views, that really comes from much later when we no longer had an organized Sanhedrin. Okay, I have to try to stop here, but anyway, I have to get with you tomorrow.